we embed the culture of stepping aside, both in our for-profits and nonprofits, it'll help, like term limits on boards.
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace, where we discuss real-time workplace issues with experts to get you the best solutions for your company. I'm your host, Carol Schultz, longtime executive coach and professional recruiter and best-selling author. Let's get into it.
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace. I'm Carol Schultz. Today, we're covering a very important yet under-discussed topic, founder syndrome. There are a couple of different ways to define it, and they both lead to the same results. First, defined as when one or more founders maintain disproportionate power and influence following the effective initial establishment of the organization, leading to a wide range of problems. Another way of looking at this is that founder syndrome occurs when a founder struggles or refuses to change gear and adopt a new mindset, approach, or skill set as the organization grows and as its strategic content changes. Consequently, this becomes the biggest constraint to growth, and there are many causes and ways to get past this. So to help us get some answers today, I am pleased to have Sophia Shaw, social impact tech entrepreneur and nonprofit expert with me. So Sophia, I really appreciate you joining me today. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Carol. I have created a software platform that helps nonprofit leaders make strategic plans. And as we know right now and always, that you need to be really agile in creating a plan and adapting that plan to any circumstance that happens. But if you don't start with a plan, you don't know where you're going during rough days. So we created Plan Perfect, my co-founder and I, and we've had a lot of initial success in working with nonprofits from Alaska to Boston, Florida, California, all over the country in laying out, helping them lay out the course of their future and helping them to achieve their missions.
What is it about? I mean, I can make my own assertions because I have volunteered for and worked for nonprofits from time to time over the years. But what do you believe is at the heart of why nonprofits need this in particular?
Nonprofits are created to help fulfill a mission, a cause. And oftentimes the founder, to get to our broader topic as well, the founder has an expertise in a certain area. And that certain area allows them to deliver the services they need to the people who need them. So maybe let's take the example of a dentist. So that dentist wants to make a clinic to help more people have dental care. So they're a fantastic dentist, but they may not know the best about business planning. So giving them, and that's no criticism.
I know one personally that exactly fits into that category.
It's no criticism of that at all. I mean, I couldn't take care of somebody's teeth.
Yep.
So it's that combination of their expertise plus a partner. And in this case, the partner is, let's say, all of the expertise that I have had over my entire career duplicated into this Plan Perfect software, that together we can help them make a plan that they can fulfill.
So, you know, founder, the kind of term founder syndrome, and it's interesting because before we found an article that you had written, I had a founder in one of my roundtables, my executive roundtables, refer to herself as having founder syndrome. I look at it a little bit differently, and I do want to talk about, I mean, like I said, I think the result is the same regardless of how it's defined, right? So it kind of has a negative connotation. It speaks to the dangers of over-involvement of a certain person, right? So let's talk a little bit about the tipping point where a founder has maybe been instrumental and super passionate and involved, and it's all going great to the point of when it starts to spiral down the
mm-hmm. Right. I think the other part of the definition is that when the organization, regardless of what it is, nonprofit, for profit, has become so associated with one person.
Yes.
So, you know, and there's a restaurant down the street from me at home that has the name of the founder. And I do have to say that I worry every time I go in there when this person is the big character in the room. What's going to happen when he opts to move along? And so how do you get the next people in the room? So it's that when it becomes so associated with it, then you can really see over time the documented patterns, both all the way from growth to maturity and then decline if somebody doesn't really think through their role and then how to pass it along to somebody else.
Yep. You know, I feel like, you know, this particular founder who had said that she thought that she felt she had founder syndrome, you know, her issue was unfunded startup, trying to bootstrap it. And believe me, I am no critic of bootstrapping, but, you know, there comes a point where you have to really look at going, you know, how well is this working for me? Do I need to go out and get a friends and family round or a business loan or, God forbid, venture capital, right? A buddy of mine who's a venture capitalist says that should be the last thing you look to do, because then they have basic control over your business. But she's, you know, she, here she is with two babies at home, starting a company and doing two or three full-time jobs for her company and not having any time to do anything else. And I think, okay, is it just your own lack of self-awareness that you don't realize that you have now called yourself as having founder syndrome? And really what it is, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. Right? Oh gosh, I have this, but you know, but I'm not doing anything to get myself out of this. So right. That's where I look at, you know, is it just self-awareness that they may be lacking, and that, you know, they may acknowledge that things, you know, need to change, but really are holding, you know, grasping tightly to how they've been doing it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, unable or maybe even unwilling to see how they've actually become, this has become a constraint.
Right. I'm sure there's a whole specialty in psychology about this, or if there isn't, there should be, because, you know, in preparation for this, I was just thinking, well, why? Why can people not let go? And I think this is a broader concept. They can't let go of their company. Maybe they can't let go of a family home. I mean, there are a lot of psychological reasons for why people don't want to think about this. I mean, there's an idea that people will live forever, or that your ego and personal identity is so tied up in the business that after you leave it, who are you? I mean, I felt this way after I left my big job as a CEO of a major cultural organization, that I was like, who am I now when I run into somebody? And so there's that ego, personal identity, there's a sense of melancholy, you know, maybe some sort of postpartum depression of like, you've made this, and now if you left it, it's the sadness, fear of boredom, maybe, of not knowing what else you do with your time, maybe some like non-clinical narcissism, you know, that you might think that like, this cannot go on without me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Really interesting. And I think if I look back a number of years, I would likely have fallen into that category, right? You know, the one who has the great vision is often the one who you look around and go, how do I replace myself, right? I mean, I think, you know, one great example, I mean, there's actually two real examples that come to my mind immediately. One is Warren Buffett finally turning over the reins to, and I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, to his, you know, number two. And the other one, of course, that I think is just equally as important is Steve Jobs turning over his company to Tim Cook,
right?
Tim Cook, thank you. It's a Friday, everyone.
I know.
We're recording this, and I think that's part of my problem. I'm a little brain dead today. But yeah, turning the company over to Tim Cook. Now, did Steve hire him in order to backfill himself? Probably, right? I mean, that would have made sense. And would Steve have done that had he not had pancreatic cancer and knew he was going to die? I mean, I don't know the answer to that, right? But I think, you know, even look, like I said, looking at myself, I thought, how am I going to bring other people in to do what I do, to know what I know, and so on and so forth? And, you know, as you and I chatted about, it's, you know, it's incumbent upon me to figure out how to do that. Because how often do you see companies just literally disappear when the founder disappears?
Mm-hmm. Right. And perhaps in some cases, that's okay. In some cases, it's okay. And in some cases, I think that the brand or the services that the organization is providing is so valuable or so valuable, they shouldn't go away. I think another part of the motivation, or probably the problem that we maybe didn't touch on yet, are also family dynamics, that I think sometimes people think, in addition to the things we said before, like denial and fear, melancholy, et cetera, that also their family dynamics that they are maybe holding on long enough because they hope that one of their kids is going to get involved, or that they actually, one of the reasons why the transition fails is that they do get their kids involved, but the kids actually aren't qualified to be involved. And so therefore the matriarch feels like, oh, we got to stay on and do this, even though I should have moved away. I mean, this is a really really complicated topic. And even if one has cancer, even if that were Steve Jobs' motivation, like kudos to him to actually step aside, because some people would just actually, you know, die in the job. So,
you know, and it's interesting that you mentioned that about the family dynamic. I was listening to a podcast this morning at the gym, and you know, they were interviewing a farmer in I think it was in Ohio. You know, they have a big farm, and of course where they make their money is soy and corn, right? And they were reviewing what had happened, you know, back in I guess it was before COVID, right? And the interesting thing is he said the average age of a farmer now is 57. And, you know, he says we need to figure out a way to bring in these younger people who are going to want to go into this business and who can be in this business, so on and so forth. And, you know, I think that it's getting harder and harder, because even, you know, I see the destruction of my state of Colorado. And when I say the destruction of it, I mean a lot. But what I mostly mean is the destruction of any farm and ranch land, which is now filled with high density tract housing, just ranches biting the dust, because the children don't want to deal with it. They don't want to have to deal with the high taxes, even for agricultural taxes, which are lower. But, you know, when you start putting it into the hundreds of acres or thousands of acres, it gets very expensive.
Right. And on the flip side, they can sell the land for a lot of money, and therefore it have, be able to take some of that, value with them without having to work the land. And again, you know, all these things, there's no value judgment in it. It's just, it's complicated. And in order for us to ensure that the businesses or the farms, et cetera, that do have value to go on are going on, we need to really engage in succession planning. One of the great joys of starting Plan Perfect this year has been working with a dozen or so over the past year associates from Kellogg, from Northwestern's mm-hmm. Business School. And they are hungry to take on some of these entrepreneurship roles. Yeah. And so we're really in our business schools and colleges and community colleges. I think entrepreneurship has really taken on a bigger role at all levels of education. I went to a high school class in Naples, Florida this last year, and they had an entrepreneurship class, each group creating a new product, thinking about a market plan. So I think the good news is that there are many, many young people who are excited about a journey of being an entrepreneur. And even if they're not the primary founder, to be able to step into a role they'd be excited about. But we, as the sort of the older guard now, need to really be thinking about how we do that.
Sophia, what tips do you have for founders to prevent founder syndrome? I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about it, but let's kind of point them out point by point.
Right. I mean, the tips are really to make succession planning be part of every conversation, and that whether that's the conversation with the board, the conversation with family, conversation with the spouse. I mean, we just saw this happen at the highest level of our government, where succession planning wasn't considered thoughtfully, and that didn't go so well. So, you know, to ensure that not only the human being, and each one of us is flawed in our own way and unable to maybe see ourselves clearly, but that the structure of whatever organization we're in is engaged in those conversations. So a board's primary role is to be thinking about what the future is, even if that founder isn't prepared to be thinking about it. So thinking through succession planning, whether that's just the obvious succession planning, contingency planning. So what if the person gets sick or they find something better to do? Who's going to fill in right away? Or then also the purposeful, long-term looking succession planning. And then really, this is the important part, documenting it both in a legal way, if possible or necessary, through an estate plan or through a corporate structure, and then also communicating it through family, the company, et cetera, and making a date.
So do you have any specific advice for those who are working for a founder who believe fits this description? And part B is there anything they can do to help combat that?
I had a client that really, when I'm in my consulting company before Play Perfect, that really, really had an issue with this. And he just simply would not step away, And it was really painful to watch, to your point, for the executive director of this organization and also the family of the founder. And the advice there is really to try all you can. So try the things I just said, bringing it up, talking about succession planning, going to the board if there is one. But then at the end of the day, if they don't, or if they're not going to move out, then you have to protect yourself. And looking for a new role or looking for a way to make sure that you yourself are healthy, I would say is my primary advice, because sometimes the whole thing just crashes and burns.
Right. You know, I had a client a couple of years back who, as many founders do, right, through founder and CEO of this organization, you know, working 80, 100 hours a week. The problem was, in this particular case, that this founder was spending 50% of their time managing people rather than growing the business and so on and so forth. And this, I also believe, is, you know, it may not be the, you know, definitive or the denotative definition, right, of founder syndrome, but so many founders are spending, they're wasting so much of their valuable time doing things they have no business doing, like having people two levels below them skip their managers because they're having issues with them.
Yeah,
that's hired me to fix some of this stuff, but unfortunately didn't really follow the whole process that I recommended, right? You know, she was not giving her, call it her executive team, right, the training and coaching they needed to really be great leaders.
That's a fabulous point. And it's one that I saw so often, that, but I've never been able to really put words around. In many of these cases, when you have maybe this narcissistic, unmovable founder, you are indeed, just as you said, you're seeing all these junior level staff in their office or being taken by under their wing in a way that is not functional from a business point of view. And I would love to see, as a solution, in addition to the things you've talked about, like succession planning or bringing out more in the open, but also how does the organization find a really nice role for that person? And as a, you know, maybe help them write a book about what their journey has been. So redirect, you know, why don't you write a book about the past of this company and why it was special? What is its special sauce that made it successful? Or maybe have them go out in a speaking circuit or get them into a meaningful role that they can do for the rest of their lives, but maybe not at the heart of the management team.
What does concern me is, because I have spent so much of my career working with young companies and startups, what concerns me is that there are so many people calling themselves founders these days, you're trying to build a company, and they really don't, and most of these are ones that are bootstrapping, right? And I look at them and I think, you're not getting, I had somebody recently tell me, well, I've got this advisor who used to work at, person who happened to work for Deloitte, the advisor. And I thought, based on what this person was building, I said, what in the world do you think this person is bringing you that is directly related? He says, well, he's done that before. I said, but he hasn't actually done the job, right? He doesn't know. And that doesn't negate any expertise that he has, but they don't really look at, where do I find the experts to bring in to give me guidance on exactly what we're doing right here? Mm-hmm. Somebody who's actually done that before or been in that role or whatever that might be. And, you know, those who are bootstrapping that own, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg, 51% of their company, at least, there's no way anybody can change that.
Yeah.
You know, I've asserted often that if Mark Zuckerberg didn't own 51% of Meta, they would have gotten rid of him by now. And you know, I think there are other cases like that. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that really contributes to this problem.
Right. At the root of it, it's a psychological problem.
Yes.
And we've all seen it in our homes, and you know, even when there's not a founder, that there's a person who's just unwilling to like let go of the knife at the Thanksgiving turkey. Like, mm-hmm. It's time to pass the knife to the next generation. And you know, I think that now that I am a founder, I've been thinking about this even more. It's become an even more acute concept. And my solution for it in our company, I mean, I'm lucky to have a co-founder who's, you know, generation younger, and also has the spirit of wanting to make sure that we're we're strong going forward. But the real solution that we're putting in place is having really good systems from the beginning that we are putting in place now to make sure the organization is really healthy from the inside out. So that's accounting systems, governance systems, legal systems, making sure that we are at our heart a healthy organization. So if I were to step aside, or my co-founder were to step aside, we could find sort of a nice fit back to it. And I think that comes because I ran a massive organization. I mean, I've worked for big companies or nonprofits my whole life. And so therefore, I know how to set the systems in place. But if somebody hasn't had that, let's go back to our dentist or restaurateur, and they're a great chef or they're great with teeth. They know what they know how to do, but maybe not how to put all those systems in place.
It is very interesting, you know, and then, you know, when you are able to see a chef restaurateur who is able to scale his or her business to multiples of different restaurants, you know, there's somebody that comes to mind here in Denver, in the Denver area, who, you know, started with one and then he had two and then he had three, and they're all different types of restaurants, mm-hmm. you know, and he's done quite well. You know, I'd like to think that he was smart enough to bring somebody in to help him do that.
Right.
I suspect he was, because he does, because most, you know, most people just don't know how. You know, your example of the dentist, I think. Yeah, I know a dentist who was a complete brilliant dentist, total failure in the business.
Right. And so finding a partner is so important. And then, you know, going back to the restaurant concept, like I was always, don't need to name names, but sometimes they go one step further. They're really successful in their business. And then they're really successful making the restaurant. They're successful making the four restaurants with the different concepts. But then all of a sudden you see them in airports and malls and you're thinking, like, yet your name is on this and yet somebody's giving you bad advice, you know?
Yeah. That well, and we have that, of course, here in Denver, you know, in certain our terminals. I'm like, oh, when did they put a Denver Chop House in there?
Yeah. Right. And so does that make you still want, and oftentimes that has a person's name on it. So it's, you know, so does that make you actually want to go to the flagship anymore and spend, you know, $40 for, you know, a steak if you could go to the airport and you're just seeing that like some meat that's been brought in from on a cart. I mean, it's a funny branding topic too.
Yeah.
Like how, when somebody wants to scale, then what is the best way to do that? Is it, mm-hmm. is that franchise model one that's actually going to help the founder's legacy? Or is it going to hurt it?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that, you know, as we kind of finish this up, the one last thing I want to look at is, as entrepreneurs are thinking about becoming founders, how can, you know, those of us who understand this get the message out to them? Because we live in a reactive society. We need to be living in a proactive society so that they can be proactive about thinking about this. Like before they actually even start their business.
Right.
I mean, how do we do that?
We could write an article, you and I. Yeah. I mean, we have this podcast. I think really kind of socializing some of these things. So, you know, saying that it's okay to have a plan. That doesn't mean that you have to. So when you start off, what are some of the basic values and tenets of your organization? That you're going to keep it fresh. You're going to keep it alive. You're going to bring in new people, not necessarily younger, but new people with new ideas. And I think if we embed the culture of stepping aside, both in our for-profits and nonprofits, it'll help. Like term limits on boards.
Yeah.
You know, a term limit on
and
a board.
In politics.
And in politics.
But as we're, you know, as we're talking about business, right? Term limits on boards, I think, is really important. You know, and it's like, I don't want to bring up the dirty subject of DEI, but I think what most people don't understand when it comes to even just diversity is that diversity isn't about color. Diversity is not about religion. Diversity isn't about gender. Diversity is all of those things, and in my mind. And what's somebody's diverse background? How is that going to help you add to and help you excel in your organization? Because you're bringing in people with different points of view. If you have people who think the same on everything, I mean, what's the point?
Right. And if you're going to market your product to an audience, then the company should in many ways reflect the demographics of that audience. And you can't do that if everybody just looks the same. or has the same ideas in the same background.
Well, you get groupthink is what I like to refer to it as, right?
So. Right.
Well, Sophia Shaw, co-founder of Plan Perfect. Thanks for joining me. This was a really interesting conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, me too, Carol. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Evolving Your Workplace. Is there a topic you want to discuss? Let us know what you think in a review. And don't forget to click follow to stay up to date on upcoming episodes. Thanks again for listening and see you next time.